Good evening. You're listening to Three Moves Ahead. I'm Len. I am your host, and I am here with our friend John Boulding.
Howdy.
And with Ian Boudreau.
Hey, everybody.
And with our recurring special guest / ancient history consultant, Dr. Brett Devereaux.
Salvete omnes.
And we are here to discuss the early access release of Manor Lords, a medieval city builder from Slavic Magic and Hooded Horse Publishing. Slavic Magic, which is technically one person, but this game was not made exclusively by one person. I think that's an important distinction, because I see that people keep throwing that around, but like, there's a lot of, you know, asset store and contractor stuff in here too. But the core of the game was developed by one person, which is pretty impressive. John, do you want to give us your perspective on what the hell is Manor Lords?
Manor Lords is a city. It's a city building game, right? It's a,
yes.
Survival city builder.
Crusader Kings. It's not Total War. It's not.
It is absolutely 100% not Crusader Kings.
There is no Crusader. There is nary a Crusader King to be found in this.
And it is 97% not Total War.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is very much a town builder or a city builder, wherein you are a sort of a slightly timeless, not quite placed in a century, medieval lord of some kind, who is in charge of your little territory and wants to expand your little plot of land into other nearby little plots of land. And you do this by building up a, you know, fake, relatively complex little local medieval economy to the point where you can support to buy mercenaries and equip your local levy to fend off raiders and other lords, and also to press your own claims on nearby territory. And to do that, you know, you got to get in good with the local authorities or what have you, and bribe the church with enough food that they're like, oh yeah, I mean, this is the most Crusader Kings part.
Yeah.
The church enough that they give you the thumbs up when you pretend to have some special ancient claim on a nearby tract of woodland.
Yeah, on a mostly empty forest that might have some bandits in it. I think it was, Rowan I was talking to about how it's kind of disappointing that you can't just conscript the bandits to become your local enforcers and just take over that way.
I was actually delighted to see that several of the mercenary companies you can hire are just explicitly a group of bandits from 20 miles or 30 miles away. So they're not your bandits, so you might as well hire them as mercenaries.
There's one bandit group called, or no, this was a mercenary group called the Crazed Geese.
Yeah.
They're just wandering around, chasing smaller groups of bandits around. Yeah. This is neat stuff.
Yeah. So John said this is not really placed in a specific place or century, but Brett, I'm curious, do you feel like you could place roughly when and where this is?
From what we have now, I feel like we are not late medieval. We are not early. We're somewhere in the high Middle Ages, late Carolingian, early post-Carolingian in terms of architecture. All the castle building is still in wood, though I'm sure that they'll add stone castles later given the key art. But what I think is actually really interesting is not just the sort of like vaguely medieval setting, but the game is kind of examining a part of the medieval aristocracy that we don't usually see in games. And that I actually find fascinating, right? Unlike something like Farthest Frontier, where you were the sort of disembodied spirit of a town, like here you're very explicitly a noble who owns land. Like you can hit a button and walk around town in third person. And this, I think, is actually really good to like where this game fits and why it isn't the second coming of Crusader Kings, because it's not, is that you're not a king or a duke or a count. You're not even really a baron. We would usually say for what this character is, this would be a castellan. You are as far down on the noble aristocracy hierarchy as you can be before you're not a noble anymore, right? Like, you control a plot of land. You're quickly going to build up like a single village, and your bargain basement fortified household next to that village. It's probably too much to even call it a castle at this point.
Oh, for sure. And
maybe call it a manor.
Well, yes.
Mine's more like it's a lodge.
So yeah. It is a manor, and the economic system that is being simulated, we in as academics, we call manorialism. Like, the title for this game is spot on. It is a manorialism simulator in which you play as the lord of the manor. So it's called Manor Lords. Like, so good. But what I want to stress here is that, like, your character isn't even really a baron in terms of your rank. Like, this is a character who, like, if you consolidate every plot on the map and you beat your opponents, you might then rise to be a baron, right? Which is the lowest level of human being Crusader Kings bothers to simulate.
Right.
Like, that's where you fit. To put it in the other direction, I rarely have pleasant things to say about Kingdom Come Deliverance. All of those petty lords that you run into, like the Lord of Scalets in that game, you're that guy. And when you call out your retinue, you're like five dudes with weapons that are actually full-time fighters that live in your castle, right? Like, that's Henry. Like, this is where that places you on the sort of the very bottom of the aristocracy, where, like, the day-to-day running of your relatively small village is in fact a huge part of, like, how you raise military force. And your army is pretty unimpressive because you're a pretty small noble. It is delightful to me that they're examining that part of the aristocracy, but I think a lot of people are coming into this imagining they're going to be like Duke William of Aquitaine rolling around with a 3,000-man army, and like, that is not this game, folks.
Yeah. You're one of the guys that gets called by one of the guys that gets called by one of the guys. Yeah. When William says, I need a 3,000 dude army.
Yes. Well, and you bring your 25 guys.
Yeah. And that's how you get 3,000 guys. It's a lot of guys with 25 guys show up.
It's something I've commented on that I feel like Crusader Kings is weird in this way that like a baron is like this sub playable ant in Crusader Kings, like framing of the world, when it's like, no, that would be like, that's like a one percenter. Like, a baron is a pretty serious guy.
I kind of love the idea that, and I agree with Brett, and I had been thinking this before, which is that the end game of this is controlling enough territory and having a dense enough population in your little area that someone's like, make that guy a baron.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That would be, it would be cool if they formalized that somehow,
but then the you win screen comes up, right? The game does not then continue with you as a baron. Like, that's it. You're done.
I don't think it could, because it has a deeper level of fidelity in the simulation. I think it's aiming for, it doesn't necessarily have it right now, but it's aiming for a deeper level of fidelity in the simulation.
Also, could you imagine
zoom out
dealing with the game systems for moving goods between different territories? If you had like 20 of them, it would be unmanageable. It's just, the game is more granular than that.
I never found that I ever had to build more than one town if I didn't want to. Like, you could just upgrade your burgage plots to start generating money out of the ether, and then you just trade for everything that you're not able to produce yourself locally.
But I think it depends on how much you wanted to scale up, but I think you're mostly probably correct in the current build. And I think it's that way for a reason in the current build, because the system's for moving things around between territories and basically inter your territory trade. Inter-village, intra-territory trade. They're not complex enough to hold up to that level of...
Yeah.
I had three little villages running at once, and I was like, I don't think it would be more fun to keep making more villages.
Right.
No, they need to work on that. It's right now, it's kind of tricky. Like, I was trying to like, oh, I'll create this village over here where the farmland is good and they'll send wheat this way. And then the main town will send weapons the other way. But it fixes the ratio of the one thing to the other thing. So there was a whole lot of wheat moving this way. And it's like, here's a bow, which sort of defeated the purpose of my plan. And it feels like it doesn't feel like that should be a restriction, because as the Lord, it is both my wheat and my bow. Like why do I have to trade with myself? But it, you know, that's I suppose actually a good segue to talking about how finished this game is.
Not finished. Nailed it.
Ian, what has been your experience so far with the early accessness of Manor Lords?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff in here where it's kind of gesturing toward future functionality, right? Where, you know, the placeholder text, or like if you want to enact a policy in your town, well, that's all kind of work in progress stuff. A lot of the upgrade tree, like as your village grows, you gain development points, I think. And then, yeah, that tree's got some stuff in it that just isn't implemented yet. There's a really cool system for diplomacy, for negotiation with you know, other leaders and with bandits and things, where you kind of open the screen and you drop paragraphs into a letter to them, and it that looks like it's going to be really neat, but it's not all there.
I love that.
It's not at all there, right? Like
yeah, there's only system. Like a couple things. I don't think it really does anything yet. But
you can like, say, I hate you. Go. Give me money.
Yeah, right, yeah, that's about it. Yeah.
And
skill issue, sincerely.
You can also say, nerd. Like, yeah. I will leave you alone for more money.
Yeah, and then there's like some like strings, like, yeah, demand money or demand underscore money, close bracket. Yeah.
Yeah, and so there's plenty of like strings, the things that are labeled like trade underscore outgoing underscore good.
Right,
whatever, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Your upgrade, like for the Burgage plot requirements, like when you hover over a button, it'll freak out a little bit. And trade seem that's one that we should probably get into at some point in time. But like there's going to be a whole system for designing your castle. That's not there yet.
No. You plop down your little lodge.
Your lodge.
And then like a tower that like lets you have the max size retinue, and then just don't touch
that's
it again.
That's all you can do, really. Yeah.
There is like a tax office, but it says in the tooltip, like purely visual work in progress, which there's a lot of stuff that is signposted like that, which I respect.
I will say that I know that a lot of that stuff has systems, because a bunch of that stuff existed and was functional in the demo from years ago now of Manor Lords.
Oh, really?
But I think, the systems existed and worked as much as the whole game worked at the time, but everything has become more complex since that time. And so I expect the decision was made, I don't like this system level of completion, so I'm going to shunt it over into the not finished bit for now and not put it in the release candidate. Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that I found kind of the most early access about it is that they've gone to the trouble of making all these different military units that you can raise, and like adding this real-time battle system. And it's like, once you get 4 or 5 regiments of guys, there's nothing that can challenge you ever again. Like the Baron, who's like your opponent, like he'll hire mercenaries and stuff, but it's like, yeah, my 4 regiments of peasants can kill your entire army, and I only took like 5 or 6 casualties, which does actually impact your labor force, which is cool. Like guys that die, like they're gone from being able to make things.
And I mean, just going back to the scale of the game again.
Yeah.
But that like your headcount in town is hugely impactful on your ability to like keep your production chains going. Especially early on, where you have to be kind of, it's worth, I think, noting that you assign tasks by family. So if you want somebody to run the like logging camp. It's a family does that. So it's a couple and whatever children they have will, you know, work at each station, but you have to keep moving them around until you have kind of a, you've grown significantly from the beginning. So yeah, like losing people in war, bad news. Cause all of a sudden you don't have nearly as many people working on like producing food and weapons and anything else your village is
making. And they also aren't working when they're raised as militia. Yes. So you can see a pretty stable food supply plummet if you keep, you know, 5 units of militia raised for a long time, which is pretty
cool. Yeah, it's actually one of my favorite things about the game is like, don't start shit in spring, you clown.
Yeah.
Right? Like those people have plowing and sowing to do.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. Don't start shit in fall, you clown. Those people have harvesting to do.
Yeah.
Like have a fight in the summer, maybe. Or at least right now, absolutely in the winter, because there's no effect from cold. There's no reason not to start a fight in the middle of winter.
Yeah, you can totally just march all the way across the map in like knee-deep, steep snow, and it doesn't really do anything. But
yeah, I'll be interested to see how, as the warfare system develops, and as the you know AI opponents develop, how that shapes the seasonality of warfare, because in a lot of cases, what you would historically speaking be trying to do to your enemy is pillage their crops and food, which makes summer and spring is when you want to deliver the attack, because that is when there are crops in the field or food in the barns. But obviously that has implications for your own agricultural schedule, because you need to get back for the harvest. I'll be interested to see how that plays out as they develop those systems.
Hire some mercenaries to go attack, you know, your enemy in the spring seems like a cool strategy that could exist in this game in the future. Because as it is now, your enemy doesn't build anything on the map, right?
Yeah.
Though that is, you know, said to be something in the future, right?
Or alternately, take your tiny retinue, stick them on horses, and raid your opponent's outlying settlements, using your speed to get away before their regular levy shows up because it's on foot, which would be just exactly what actual manor lords did historically. That was like 90% of warfare is I get my 6 buddies, we're on horses, we're in full armor, we're going to roll out and engage in agricultural devastation, raiding and pillaging with our like 12 squires who are also on horses. And then if a real military force shows up, we're on horses, we just leave.
That would also be a really interesting replacement for the way claims currently work, which is basically that people pay tithes in food to the church, and this generates points that you can use to make a claim on a province. But like, if you're raiding somewhere on your borders consistently and the other manor lord can't protect that area, maybe that would just give you like a casus belli to invade. Mm-hmm. And like, well, I can protect you if you pay me taxes. Look at this joker. He hasn't been stopping me from stealing your crops for years. So, turning the way that border raids could turn into a wider conflict is something that I feel like hasn't been explored as much as it could have in strategy games in general, where like low level fighting turns into more serious fighting.
Or that you just have endemic low-level fighting that has an economic role in the society. I mean, this is something, I know we don't want to talk about Crusader Kings forever, but something I wish Crusader Kings would do better is like the problem of being a big empire with non-state neighbors is that you just have perpetual border problems. And they sort of experiment with this with like raiding mechanics, but it's never quite as big a focus. And I think the game has, Manor Lords has the opportunity to develop that at its sort of very micro level scale, precisely because it is at the scale where mounting that raid is a significant activity.
So the other,
absolutely. And I like the idea that it's sort of ambiguously placed somewhere in Europe, but I do like the idea that in the future, that sort of internal politics stuff can get advanced. and you can have interesting stuff like the king says, no one's supposed to cut down trees this year, right? Like things like that happened, like interesting stuff like that happened historically in response to weird events, and they affected local relations. And I like the idea that you could have those kinds of things happen, right? Where like it's peaceful this year, like no fighting or else you're in trouble with somebody way up the chain from you, or somebody way up the chain from you says you need to send your retinue and a bunch of militia to fight in a war. And so you have to send those people off map and they're gone for 8 months. And then do they come back? I don't know. How many of them come back? I don't know. Right. Like I think those kinds of the political situation that your little town is in is really rich historically. And it's very exciting, the amount of design space that's available to this game.
Yep.
Yeah, that would, if you could like piss off like the Duke or the King and like they send troops in to put you in your place, like that would suddenly make a lot of the military stuff way more interesting if you're, you know, having to fight people who are bigger than you.
Well, and this was, I mean, this was also a factor in the sort of politics of the period. Yeah, sure, the king can absolutely smash flat any individual baron or castellan or what have you, but if you hole up in your castle, you can make it really annoying and take a really long time. So is it really worth it for the king to sit on your head?
Build a big enough stone tower and suddenly become obnoxious. I mean, there's great historical examples of that. And there's also great historical examples of like guy who was important, not because he was in charge of a ton of land, but purely because of how impressive his stone fortress was, right? Like the guy that the historical book, people love it. A Distant Plane, Distant Mirror. Brett might know this. Am I right there? Is that the right title?
I don't know.
Tuchman.
Yeah, it's Distant Mirror.
Distant Mirror. It's about the sort of 14th century in France and England. And a big interesting part of that is that her sort of main character she follows as a focus through the book is a guy who is a baron. And he's not even a very especially big baron, but his family owns a big ass castle that's near Paris. And so he's just important for no reason at all. He's not actually particularly powerful, but he could make the king's life hell. So he gets to come on all the fun adventures and go fight the English.
It's like the phrase in Game of Thrones, you know?
Sure.
Like,
yeah. That's a great example as well.
Yeah. That's also something, not to get back into Crusader Kings, but Crusader Kings, I feel like could do more with castle rights. I think it's a privilege that gives you month like plus 10 defensiveness or something at this point, but like, being allowed to even build castles is something that was an issue at various points in time.
Oh, yeah, very much so. The right to crenellate.
So the other interesting thing about how the economy works in Manor Lords, this might be my favorite new thing that they did, is that they've added the concept of backyard workshops where quite a bit of your economy just takes place at people's houses. Like there's not a building called a brewery. You build a brewery extension onto someone's house and then they go brew beer in the backyard. That's the only way to get beer. There's not like,
all of those people in that house become artisans right away. Like once you make that upgrade. Yeah. Those people are locked into that. What I mentioned, you know, switching people around on and off different jobs early on, but yeah, once you start adding those workshop upgrades, everybody in that house becomes locked into that task. So whether they're a tailor or a armorer or what are some other ones?
Joiners.
Some of the higher special. Yeah,
you can, there are quite a few.
Or bowyer, yeah. You can do some, there's some backyard stuff that doesn't require that. Like you can put goats or a vegetable garden.
Chickens.
Or some chickens. Yeah. And you can kind of, that doesn't disrupt anything. Everybody lives their regular peasant life that way. But once you add some of these more specialized artisan workshops, then that's what they do from that point onward.
Yeah. Which, and it makes sense because that family is going to be skilled artisans in a trade. They might be members of a guild. Like they're not going to
plow
your fields. Like they're people that matter.
Time. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it really does create kind of a distinction between like burghers and peasants eventually, which is kind of interesting. And then they you have to actually basically zone. I'm using the term zone, even though that's a modern term. You have to like zone a marketplace, and then these artisans will go automatically set up stalls to sell their stuff, and that's how the game determines whether or not the people have access to it, is by like, is there a market stall selling this? It's not enough to just have people making it. Like, they have to then go sell it too, which, like, you know, maybe one member of the family is doing that while another one is making shields or something.
Yeah.
Right. And I love that they actually do that, that like one member of the family is managing the stall, and then another member of the family is actually like doing the stuff, and then the third member of the family is like provisioning the household. I just, the household economics, there's so much room for, I think, rich mechanics in there, but also just for once to see that element realized, as opposed to, I mean, even in a game like Farthest Frontier, which is very granular, like all of the people that live in a house, they're not a household. They just all happen to be assigned to the same dwelling.
Yeah.
Whereas here, they're in family units, and the family unit is the basic economic unit of labor, which is correct for the way these societies were organized.
And the it's fact such that a- I mean, it is so, like, it's granular to the point where, you know, if there's not somebody free to guide the oxen, then you can't move logs around. Like, like every single thing that you use, every raw material, every finished good, everything in between, every single thing has to be hand carried, touched, and moved to the place where it needs to be used. I mean, and I guess Dwarf Fortress does this, but like it's almost an obsessive level of detail that I think just is, it's a really interesting way to set this up, because you have to imagine, you know, like a lump of raw iron ore coming out of the ground being taken by someone to the bloomery, where someone refines that into an iron slab, and then someone takes that to a storehouse where there's a family that works at the storehouse who distributes those things around or collects them all up. And every single, like eggs or fabric or weapons, anything that you make, anything that you use is all treated with this level of detail. And I think that's amazing.
The other thing I'm really wondering about this system, like right now, it seems like every family is at least generated as a three-person unit, and they don't vary in size. But the possibility of like generational cycling and varying sizes creates also something really interesting. Like, what do you do if your blacksmith is a childless widower?
Right.
Like that suddenly is a problem for your rate of production. You know, what do you do if you have a family that is much too large as a unit of labor for the job that they do? Because the answer in the medieval world is, well, you're stuck with it because they live on that farm. Like, that's their plot, and they're not going to reconfigure their family to be convenient for your labor needs because, you know, people have families for other reasons, like love and companionship and so on. And weird, that's
weird.
You know, I know, but like, and then like the nerdy historical economist sits here and is like, no, right? But you're inefficient as a unit of labor for that occupation. And they don't care because they're busy having babies because they like children.
And your solution is
no problem, because there'll be a plague at some point and half of them will die. So
yeah.
It's okay.
Well, problem solved, right? also
die.
True.
The solutions available to you in a lot of those situations are really cool and would make interesting gameplay. Like, yeah, you can get rid of or displace the old widower blacksmith, but like, this is a 300 human being town, and everyone in town is going to dislike you, the guy in charge, for making that choice. Like, you
could take that guy out
and bring in an artisan from a nearby village or a city or something for some expense of cash. But like, you have created an issue for yourself, a discontented populace. Like, the opportunities there are really excellent.
Though we should be clear, really excellent design opportunities, not yet implemented.
Not in this video game at this time. A thing that is in this video game at this time, to bring it back around to how a household is built, is we actually talked about this on the Farthest Frontier show, which was the concept in all in a lot of these games. You'll have like a vast field of vegetables as a thing, which wasn't really how that worked at all in that period, right? Vegetables.
No one is planting a field of carrots.
Yeah, vegetables came from someone's, you know, cottage garden. And the system of burgage, which is sort of like, here's your plot. This is where your house is going to be. And then also you can have your chickens or you can have a little garden or whatever out back, is how you build homes in this. You plot out burgage plots. And so you get that really excellently characteristic, like medieval settlement shape out of the game, where you have these roads and then you have these long, narrow plots of land next to them with people's homes on them. And I really love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For those playing along at home who are curious about this word burgage, what a burgage is it's actually essentially a rental unit, right? Because the lord owns the whole village. And so how do you assess rent on people's houses? Because you assess rent on their farmland by taking a slice of the agricultural produce. And so a burgage was essentially a rental plot, which is also presumably why when you set up for taxes, your taxes are a slice of the wealth of all the people in the burgage. Is like, yes, that is how it works. I was really pleased to see like the deep cut of like, you are zoning out the rental units that you as a lord decide upon because you own the dirt, even if they own their houses.
But you know what you don't own and can't spend at will to do anything you want? Everyone's money. All the liquid wealth in the community in these little little hamlets you're building belong to a sort of regional stock of money, right? It is settlement wealth
regional
that belongs
wealth
to all the people who live in that little area, as opposed to your personal treasury. And if you want that money, if you want to get at it, you have to raise taxes so that it flows into your personal wealth. But I love that you can use that settlement wealth to do things like conduct trade, right? Like bring in stuff from outside that's being bought, sell things off to increase that settlement wealth. And you can also do an excellent, the excellent stuff of like, oh yeah, buy chickens, right? They're going to bring in chickens for their backyard or what have you. Mm-hmm. That sort of stuff. I really enjoyed that.
Anything that would be something the peasants or the burghers would buy themselves, you can buy out of that pool. Yeah.
Right. And it's really a particularly delightful thing to me, and all the way up to like the final upgrades for a lot of the houses and stuff, right? Like if you want to upgrade it to a really nice plastered home with a stone foundation, that the money for that stuff that presumably comes from outside the community comes out of the regional wealth.
Yeah, there's also the really interesting, like based on how you draw a burgage plot, you can put like a secondary residence on there, which is I thought was kind of interesting. Like if you
it's a classic medieval thing too, right? Like build ultra this is kind of wide. Let's cram another entire family unit on here as well.
Right.
Yeah, and it's always like kind of a slightly smaller, shittier house than the main house.
That's the best part. Yeah.
But it creates like a nice texture once you're built up to like
it's a nice sublet for your renters or whatever in modern terms.
Yeah.
Called the in-laws suite or something.
As a subletter myself, I felt very represented by this system. The one place that this kind of breaks, I think, with some of its core ideas is when you actually get into farming, though, because I don't know, maybe Brett, you could give some more insight on this, but it treats the farmhouse as a separate workplace that you leave your house and you go put on your farmer's hat and you go to work at the farmhouse, which to me seemed odd that everything else was tied to a residence. Almost everything else. There's a few exceptions like the tannery and the mine, but that the people who work on the farms go to work in a farmhouse.
Yeah, that was a little odd. I mean, what they have like for the farmhouse, you know, it looks like what you might get in a rural farmhouse, like what a rural peasant house might look like. So, I mean, I get what they're riffing off of, but yeah. So the way that land, agricultural land usage around a manor would have normally been structured, I understand why they didn't go this way, is you would have divided the fields around the core village or town settlement. And when I say divided, into a dozens, if not hundreds of tiny little narrow strips. And every family would be allotted several of those strips, and they would not be adjacent strips. So your family would have, like, you have two bits over there and one bit over there, and then one on the hill up there and one down in the valley down there. And all of those, if you add them up collectively, are like an acre and a half. And the reason you split it up like that is so that if, let's say it rains really hard and all the low fields flood, no family is just hosed, right? Because they have, all of them have a chunk of the high fields too. Or maybe the wheat crop fails, but rye is good. Well, everybody is distributed. And so, like, normally you wouldn't have like the farmhouse. All of the families that aren't specialist artisans would be engaging in agriculture in addition to whatever else they did. And you would have subdivided the agricultural space in order to enable that and to diversify every household's holdings so that they're never at risk of complete failure, you hope. They kind of capture a little bit of this in that, I mean, one, the farmhouse, because you need somewhere to assign farming families. Most workplaces take two or three families. I think the farmhouse takes eight.
Yeah,
it's the assumption is a lot, and you do really need a lot of people in order to make that shift from like meat and berries to like grain, which you do eventually need to make. And you do see them farming collectively, like they're all rolling out into one field and they're going to get that field done, and then they're all going to roll into the next field. And so you do get a sense that this is a very collective effort from the village, which is correct. It wouldn't be like modern agriculture where you're like, this family owns those 100 acres and this family owns these 25 acres. Like, the village is going to move collectively through the cycles of farming.
Yeah, because like
team effort.
I have less than an acre and I can barely do it. Like, it's by hand, I can't imagine.
But yeah, no. No, these farms are really small.
Yeah, they're comedically small, but also, like, we've talked about this a lot. Correctly sized farms changes the scale of the game completely, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. But I mean, compared to modern farms, medieval farms are tiny.
They're very little.
I mean, here, of course, my my kind of information is like Roman farming. Like, the average Roman farm is 5 to 10. The Roman unit is a eugerum. It's about 2/3 of an acre. So you're talking about like the standard, like a decently chunky Roman farm for like a single family is, 6 acres, 5 acres. Which is like a modern farm is like 50, 100, 200, 400 acres. These are really small because you're working them by hand. You're working them quite intensively. And also you're going to subdivide your available agricultural space so that it can support all of the people. You're not thinking about how to maximize the profit. You're thinking about how to feed all of the people in your village with whom you are friends or related to, and therefore would like them not to starve and die.
Or at the very least, on whom you are depending to rally into a local militia and defend.
Yes, also that.
Raiders, right?
Yeah.
Like, this sort of important conceits, I guess. To me, the farmhouse as a conceit felt more like this is the shared barn or granary, yep, which to my understanding, at least, isn't unheard of.
That's not period, wild, no.
Right? Like, this is the village granary. We're going to bring everything back here and thresh it as a group, right? That to me felt more like what the quote farmhouse is supposed to be. Okay. And it's also where the if you have a dedicated ox, right, to plow, that's where it lives.
Yes. Yes. The ox is communal property. The ox is probably the Lord's property, because who else is rich enough to own animals?
Yes. And I love, I actually really love that part of this game where the value of animal labor is really well represented, right? Like the oxes don't just manifest out of the ether when it's time to plow or what have you.
And early on in the game, the decision to invest in animals is like, you are burning a lot of your village's wealth to invest in animals. It is a significant decision, which is good because yes, it would have been.
Well, they also have the there's sort of a joke right now that sheep are overpowered because you can, the only pasture animal I think you can currently get is sheep.
Yeah,
they don't have cows or anything like that yet, but you can set your sheep to pasture in the fields when they're not growing anything, and they will actually fertilize the fields, which I found was pretty interesting because it does have crop fertility that you can deplete like Farthest Frontier did.
And that was an actual agricultural strategy. This was ages ago, but I read an interesting article about modern subsistence farming in parts of West Africa where they noted that one of the key elements that distinguished their rich farmers from poor farmers was access to wells. And it wasn't because the farmer had the water. It's because incoming transhuman shepherds moving like goats and other animals would need to water them. And so you could trade well access for them to have their animals crap in your fields, and that would fertilize your fields. And that was a key source of capital, that the well got you access to manure. So the idea that this town, it has significant pasturage, that it's going to use its animals to generate manure for its fields, and that that's going to be a significant thing, and therefore the sheep are a significant element of the Lord's capital, is like, yes, also spot on. Also, sheep are overpowered. The Mongols agree.
That's true. Though I'm shocked, truly shocked, that you cannot eat sheep.
They produce wool and hides, but I guess
goats are only good for hides.
They throw all the meat out, I guess.
But at the same time, I think the times, I can't say I've played this game long enough for a sheep to die of old age, so or get old enough that it would be worth butchering. So maybe they do, just at a very slow rate.
You can't get meat from chickens either. It's just eggs.
It's a little bit weird.
So the all venison diet.
I do think they should eat the chickens, because anyone who's worked with chickens for any length of time will learn the lesson that chickens are huge assholes and we should be eating them.
Yeah, this is true.
Apologies to the vegans and in the audience.
No, I'm not making any apologies. Chickens are assholes.
The farm I stayed at on Norway, the rooster would chase their youngest child around to the point that she needed to be supervised if she was going outside, because this rooster was such a giant asshole. They're tiny. They're tiny dinosaurs.
They have one emotion, and it's hatred.
They're mad at us for displacing them as the dominant life forms, and they haven't forgotten about it. So the sort of we've talked about this on the Farthest Frontier episode a little bit, and I feel like that game and Manor Lords are both sort of moving this idea of like a pre-industrial city builder in like interesting directions, where they each add like some little touches of realism that we haven't seen before. The one thing I think Manor Lords is missing majorly that Farthest Frontier did have was how much Farthest Frontier thought about food preservation and like why silage is good, and like why you need like canners and coopers in your town.
Why you need barrels and jars and cellars and root cellars and things like that.
Yeah,
and there's one place where this like kind of granular approach to each good does break down, because you can put as much meat and berry, like raw meat and berries, into your granary, and they'll just keep forever.
Yeah,
yeah.
Like not outside,
also,
it's you can
also getting it like
refrigerated.
Yeah. Also getting at like what stage is the right storage stage for each foodstuff. Like it's a little weird in Manor Lords that like the wheat comes in, you thresh it immediately, you mill it immediately, and then you like bake it into bread and then you store the bread. And it's like, no, no one does that. You store threshed grain. That is the storage stage because flour doesn't keep. And bread certainly doesn't keep, right? So you store, you definitely thresh first and then you stick it in a sack.
Yes, because remember, kids, this is before we started bleaching all the flour.
Yes. Yes, this is the period where the quality of your bread is in part determined by how many tiny rocks are in it from the millstones. But like, I'd love to see them develop that a little bit more, though I am also kind of chill with the idea that Manor Lords and Farthest Frontier are interested in both different kinds of medieval settlements and in different aspects of them, right? When it comes to medieval town builders at this point, we are sort of embarrassed by riches, right? And we have a pretty capable game that is really interested in simulating the economics of like what essentially, you know, medieval burger town is really like what Farthest Frontier is interested in, like a you know, proper commercial town,
the kind of town that a baron might actually give a shit about.
But probably not rule. The kind of town that's probably too large and complex for he and his six mounted armored thugs to rule. So he probably has an arrangement with like a town council that actually runs that town, and they exist outside of his direct network.
The kind of town that rather than the Duke of Aquitaine saying, "I need 25 guys," he says, "I need 50 crossbowmen."
Yes. And there's a crossbow guild in the town that furnishes that for him. There's a really good book, I can't remember the author's name right now, on the archery guilds of Flanders and how they serve in the armies of the Dukes of Burgundy and where they fit in the social network, because that's the militia of the town. But yeah, like that's Farthest Frontier. And then this is a game about castle towns. And they have a different relationship with the Lord, and their economic and military purpose is different. And so the games have different focus, and I'm really interested to see the two of them develop side by side, and also just really fiercely bitter that the Middle Ages keeps getting really good city builders and the ancient world gets Nebuchadnezzar, goddammit.
Yeah. You know,
honestly, that game is miserable.
It's a lot more, when I think about it that way, this game is much more like Prussia into Poland during like the Eastern Crusades than it is, or even, and it also at the same time, like a dash of like rural England more than it is like Northern France and the Low Countries.
Yeah.
Right. Because it's much more broad swaths of countryside that only kind of have people living in them, that are then centralizing into hamlets, rather than like pretty established town centers for tribal groups that are coalescing and growing up into big towns and cities.
Yeah, though I will, if I must get my historian hackles up about something, like there's no greenfield settlement in this era, folks. Like there would always have been people living there.
Oh, sure. My assumption is that the Teutonic Order just rolled through and butchered everyone who used to live here. Just genocided
everybody. Yeah. They did do that a few times. And to be fair, like the only game I can think of that ever really even was remotely interested in grappling with the idea of maybe there's a pre-existing population here of like small villagers was Children of the Nile. And like nobody else has revisited that. I remain grumpy that like Children of the Nile was so ahead of its time.
It's actually weird to me when you put it that way, that one of the only games I can think of that's like some people are going to have lived here for a while before you get here is Workers and Resources Soviet Republic.
Where I haven't played that and I need to.
Workers and Resources.
Every time Baldings done it again. Workers and Resources. It's true, though, in Workers and Resources, on most of the generic maps, when you start out, there are a bunch of old style Eastern European city centers scattered around where people have lived there for a long time. And if you leave them alone and don't try and make them work in your newfangled factories, they will continue to live just as they did for a very long time without you. And trying to engage with and get that population into a modern economy is part of how you play that game, right? It would be interesting if in a future version of Manor Lords, rather than sort of popping down new settlement tents at an expense of gold on nearby areas, you were like sending some of your guys over there to politely convince them. And by politely convince them, I mean have swords and armor in their presence while telling them who they're going to pay taxes to now.
Yeah.
The new locals, like, you're going to start doing what we tell you to now. We've let you sort of off the hook for long enough, but this is technically his stuff or what have you.
It's very interesting to me that a game called Workers and Resources Soviet Republic respects the limits of player autonomy more than most other city builders do.
Again, coming from the ancient world, just give me a game where when I build houses and workplaces, I actually have to care about the population. They don't just stream in an unlimited row from off map. There was a point I was playing this article I was writing. I was playing the remake of Pharaoh, and because it's weirdly buggy, they never figured out how the crocodiles work. So if you have crocodiles on your map, they just regularly eat people, and like the police are supposed to solve the problem, but they don't. But I realized it doesn't matter because replacements for those people immediately come in from off the edge of the map. It doesn't matter. Crocodiles eat a third of the people in your town every year, and it's fine because this game fundamentally does not care about the people that live in your town. And like the fact that if you rally your army in Manor Lords, like you're going to go beat up the bandits and you badly misjudge it and you get half of your village killed, you're in trouble. I'm like, oh, so good. The people actually matter.
Like that's going to have knock-on effects for dozens of hours of gameplay afterwards, right? Like, yeah, congratulations. You wiped out most of the adult male generation of your village, you big idiot.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, you're talking about like the Teutonic Order and all the region names in Manor Lords feel kind of German.
Yeah, that was my thinking of like, are we in Silesia? Yeah. Like where?
The other thing is
It feels Central Europe to me.
The retinues that you hire, like if you get them like the best possible gear, they do look like very like late medieval metal men. Like they're not these milites with chain shirts and like nasal helms.
But they're not like free plate over a gambeson, right? Like they're wearing plate over chain.
Yeah.
So they definitely have that like pre.
I didn't equip my guys nearly this heavily, so I don't know what that looks like. Shoot.
I got really excited about the idea that you could do that. There's a couple things in the game that I was like, oh, that's a beautiful, small, excellent touch, which is like you can order out and buy plate armor for your dudes, right?
I just didn't get around to it.
Or whatever, and they come back with it. There's a cool element there where if you have a local armorer who can produce plate armor, you can instead purchase it in your own village, and it's both less expensive and the money goes into the local wealth rather than disappearing off the map, which is super neat, right?
Yeah,
that is amazing.
It's a really cool way that the economy and the army system is tied together. Is that like if you have archers, every one of those bows you had to either make from a boyar who lives in your town or you had to trade for it. And you know,
which like for the record, if you want the hack on how to make a fuck ton of money, make every war bow in the entire kingdom in your little village.
And you do have to like specialize pretty heavily to get like someone who can make plate armor. Like that's going to be most of your development points for that.
Right.
Village.
Yeah. Each of your little hamlets has a tech tree of development points. Yeah. And the options are very limited right now, but you can use them to be like, okay, this village has the heavy plow or what have you. Right.
Right. And it's like they'll use the best like armor and helmets that are available. Like when you call the militia, they're going to go to a storehouse somewhere and like grab a spear and grab a shield. Is
well, they keep them at home.
Oh, do yeah. they?
They do. There's specific little lineups on the houses. Like this house has its correct complement of bows because the people who live here are bowyers in your militia. It's so good.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. But I was thinking too about the Teutonic Order thing, that it would be really cool if they just had neutral villages on the map that you could eventually take over. Mm-hmm. Like there's some Balts living over there and they have like a parish church, but they're still kind of pagan. Maybe like that would be an interesting way to make expanding across the map, you know, more interesting. The other thing I think would be really fascinating would be to have something almost like Tassing from Pentiment, where if you could have like the church owns this land, and so we can't just go take it from the abbey or whoever it is that has yeah. been put in charge of it. Like we have to, you know, deal with them.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to know what my like, okay, it's 7 years from now and Manor Lords is like finished, right? Yeah. And it's 1.0. If you want to know what my, yeah. my DLC is, like give me the DLC where I give a chunk of my land to the church and they build a monastery on it or what have you, right? Like that's an excellent, because the way that monasteries affected local economies is awesome. It's totally fascinating stuff.
Well, and I mean, in a lot of cases, monasteries acted as lords. Like you could play as a monastery, like you don't build right. a manor, you have a monastery, you have a bunch of monks, they do nothing, they eat a lot of food, the rest of the game works as normal.
Excuse me.
Including they do the armed retinue.
They brew beer, they, you know.
No, they brew beer and they pray and they do lots of religious stuff. Yeah. But I mean like
they pray and they take sumptuous donations from the other people nearby yeah. to pray for That's, them after their yeah, own
you
death.
Need, you need a prayer base to be able to distribute indulgences to
No, it's like populace. You save up prayer points and then you can call an earthquake down on you know,
that would rock.
probably not for a historical city builder, but you know, it's an interesting idea. I did want to ask Brett, since you're here, like what would your ideal like ancient era city builder look like? Like what kind of features do we need that we're just not getting?
I think so. For me, for an ancient world city builder, I would like to see more attention on the actual people that live in your city. I would like to see household production. But the big thing that I would want to see from an ancient city builder is an effort to tackle the socioeconomic sort of class distinctions where the city is run by a rentier elite that live in the city and own most of the land, but not all of the land. And then you have middling farmers that live in the city, but farm land around it. And then you have artisans that live in the city. And then you have the urban poor, that these groups all have competing political objectives and are different sorts of people that want to reshape the city in different sorts of ways. And then kind of layering a sort of civic governance as the city develops and you're making sort of choices. Do you develop the city to provide housing for the urban poor? Do you instead build a whole bunch of really fancy rich Roman people townhouses? Those sorts of questions I think would be really interesting to dive into rather than the tendency of ancient city builders these days, which is to be factorio but bad, where it's like a pure... Right. I mean, because this is all from the old Impression city builders, which developed the way they did because of the limitations of what you could get to run on a computer in 1995. And I loved Caesar 2 and Caesar 3 too. So that's it's like I was there with you. But like we can now actually simulate all of these people, and I would like us to do it. And then ask questions about their political relationships and their economic relationships in the city builder in a way that I think continually rehashing the Impressions formula, it's just an economic engine. And yeah. I'll be blunt, as a pure engine of production, like Factorio is more interesting and complex.
Yeah. We were talking at one point on the Discord about how like remaking the Impressions city builder is the same trap as like everybody doing an off-brand Space 4X wanting to rename mm-hmm. Master of Orion. Like, yeah, it's It's not something I'm super interested in this day and age compared to a Manor Lords or Farthest Frontier or Workers and Resources. But
yeah, the one thing I would say that the ancient space would have that would be different from a Farthest Frontier or Manor Lords, and this would be interesting to tackle from a design perspective, is that you're making a much bigger city, right? I mean, like classical Athens has tens of thousands and eventually hundreds of thousands of people in it, right? Like these are potentially much larger urban centers with greater complexity. And
rather than, I'm going to interject with, I love this idea, especially because you would have major concerns like how much should we subsidize our shipbuilding program?
Right. And also like serious, you could actually have like policy questions. Do we subsidize grain prices in the city? It's going to cost a fortune and the rich will hate it, but then we won't have bread riots every week.
Yeah.
Right. Which is obviously like famously a problem in Rome, but Athens also had policies designed to hold down food prices. It was illegal to export grain from classical Athens. And instead, like grain could only flow into the Piraeus. It could never flow out because the concern, right, was to keep food prices in a very dense populated area from exploding upwards. On the flip side, right, Alexandria was like food flows out. It does not flow in because, you know, Ptolemy, the insert number here, needs money for his armies. And this is how he gets it because Egypt is grain rich. And so those kinds of political decisions would be really interesting in the context of a community that is at a much larger scale than what, say, a medieval city builder would be. I mean, like, ironically, something like Skylines actually simulates about the correct number of agents for these cities, like moments before Skylines 2 melts your computer and burns down your house.
Well, and of course, I'm always very interested in pre-modern sanitation and the eternal question, mm-hmm. of, you know, when you get this many people concentrated in one place, you have to figure out what we're going to do about all the poop. So,
and you have to figure out, and this may boggle people, who owns all the poop?
That's gold right there.
This was a major question in ancient and medieval law. Who owns the poop and who owns the pee? Because you use the pee as bleach and cleaning because you ferment it essentially into an ammonia compound. This is what fullers do. And then who owns the poop because it is valuable as fertilizer?
Obviously, the Night Soilman's Guild owns the poop, Brett. Yeah.
So in some towns it does, but often in medieval villages, the assumption is that the lord owns the poop, but the household owns their own pee and can sell it.
By the way,
amazing.
Manor Lords does have a smell map mode, which is not implemented yet.
It's not working yet.
So for the
moment, you can plop a tannery down right next to the tavern and nobody cares.
Yeah, that's not going to last.
I'm assuming that's not going to be the case in 1.0. But yeah.
Yeah. You know, 10 years from now when 1.0 releases.
when is the poop update? We need to know.
We do keep making 7 years jokes on 1.0 for this. I'm not sure that that's going to be true.
Yeah.
I don't think it's 7 years.
Because I think that's how long it's been in development as of now.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think
first showed up like 2000 or 2020.
I think they announced it in 2020. Yeah. So, yeah. And it's probably been in development longer than that. So.
Yeah. It's like an announced 2020. I think that first demo was 2021. Hmm.
Yeah, I'm trying to think on the early access scale. This is more fleshed out than like 2013's, what was it, update 17 of RimWorld that went live on Steam. there's more to it than that, but I just feel like I want to reiterate the warning to people. This is not like an it's almost done open beta. This is like right. For realsies early access.
Yeah, and like what's here is fun, but like none of the game modes are game modes that are going to be final in the release at all.
Yeah,
right. Like the ways of playing it right now are not the way a final game is going to play.
Yeah,
that stuff's pretty important to say.
Yeah, but I think like the bones on this are real good. I am excited to see where this goes. What's there is fun, but yeah, it's very unfinished. And I see the hype building around it. I see the developers being extraordinarily responsible, trying to deflate the hype. So I hope this doesn't blow up in their faces. Cause like the publisher, the developer, like, hold up people, here's what the game actually is, rather than like No Man's Sky it and just like riding the hype train to millions of dollars and disappointment. But you know, I think people need to calibrate their expectations for what this is going to be, but I think it seems like it's going to be really good at what it's going to be.
You know, one thing I think that may help, I mean, this may be drive that bubble of hype. But Mandalorians looks really good. Like it screenshots so well.
So pretty.
Like when you angle the camera up and like kind of parallel with the ground and look out over the rolling hills.
Yeah. Which I played for like 15 hours before I realized you could like look at the skybox and it would be pretty. And I was like, what the fuck?
Even like the way that the land kind of lays, right? Like it looks so much like a pastoral agricultural setting. It's so charming to look at in all different seasons too. I mean, it photographs so well, and I can kind of see how that might have people expecting something that's at a level that it's not. Like it looks so like it looks so polished.
Animations too, like the animations for doing things are so detailed, like the way that they get water from the well, like it's like it looks so realistic. You'll see people like rolling barrels down the street from the brewery.
Oh, and there's a really great, really delightful thing in this, which I can't think of any other game. I mean, I'm sure there's games. I'm sure I could think of one if I tried, but a game that simulates the handcart, a like vitally important piece of technology for a very long time, exists in this game. And I love that. Like, I just love that. Yeah, a person can actually carry more stuff than they carry in their arms. Great. Yeah. I've got great news.
It's also like, it's just a great game to like really zoom in on your town and just watch people go about their day. Or just to like zoom in on people's Burgage plots and look at their houses, because they're not all the same house copy pasted over and over again. They have obviously different like backyard things, but because each plot is slightly different in size, it feels like a real organic village or town. It's real pretty.
Yeah, it's interesting that sort of this narrative has like grown up around it, where you know they had I think 3 million wish lists on Steam or something,
I don't understand.
It's odd for a game this niche, but they just some sort of hit some sort of, you know, they say it's impossible to predict what's going to hit. And this just happened to be something that I was talking to Dan Stapleton, the reviews editor at IGN, about it, which, by the way, my early access review currently has like a 2-to-1 ratio of downvotes to upvotes, all like entirely from people who haven't played it yet. I told them I've never seen a game develop sort of a fan cult like this before, around largely a game that they made up that doesn't exist and that the developers have tried to tell them doesn't exist. But
I've never seen this genre develop that kind of a weird cult.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I know why. And the answer is that the last medieval Total War game released in 2006. This is Creative Assembly's fault, right? People have been jonesing for Medieval 3 for almost 2 decades now. And they looked at the trailers and they're like, oh, this is the Medieval 3 I've been waiting for. And it's just like, no, it's not. It's a different, really good game, but it's not that game. You need to wait another decade for CA to, pardon my language, unfuck themselves to make that game. This isn't that. It is another different thing.
Ian, any final thoughts, recommendations,
Yeah, I mean, I do think that probably for most people who got excited about this, it's a, you know, wait for a while. But I do think that, like, as we've, I mean, we've been talking for about an hour about what we've played, and what's there is, I don't know, what, 7 to 10, maybe 12 hours. It's a really solid, like, it's just one of the, like, in the hand, it's one of the most pleasant to play city builder or village builder experiences I've had in a long time. So, like, yeah, I do want to caution people that, yeah, there's not a lot here yet, but what is there is really good. And, I'm looking forward to seeing where they go.
Yeah. I think you can have a lot of fun for 10 to 15 hours, and then you're going to have seen, like, you're not going to have literally used everything in the game, but, like, you're going to have seen what there is to see. And as long as you have that in your head, you probably have a lot of fun.
You're going to be waiting for church tithes to give you enough authority that you can claim the last two spots on the map.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
From the Baron, whose army is not powerful enough to deal with you anymore. So, yeah, Brett, would you recommend, I almost said Farthest Frontier again. Would you recommend Manor Lords at this point?
I
mean,
I definitely recommend Farthest Frontier. Think that I think that description that, like, if you're okay in going in for it to support the development of the project and to get like 10 hours out of it at the price point, that's a good idea. Otherwise, yeah, watch it develop and see how it goes, because it's still in a pretty unfinished state. But I do want to say, I feel like what is here is really quite strong. They're just, yeah, it's like 10, 15 hours. And not yet much more than that.
Yeah, I think we have kind of a consensus here. That's basically what I would say too. You will have a really nice, like, art project to look at afterwards if you're the type of person that likes, you know, like me, that likes playing city builders, so that I can just go in and kind of experience my city once it's up and running. And you can even do that as a character who runs around in third person. Like, you will have something very, very neat to look at the end of those, you know, 15, maybe 20 hours, depending on how much you care about the victory conditions and the warfare system. Yeah, there's only the one map. There's not a lot of incentive to make, like, multiple towns that are specialized and to trade resources between them. You know, you can do that. It's just kind of fiddly at the moment. So you're kind of just going to be making the same town on the same tile most of the time, I feel like. I had fun with it. I don't dislike it in any way. I just think it's going to be probably, you know, a couple updates before it gets to a point, at least a couple updates before it gets to a point that I think it's replayable on the same level as, like, maybe a Farthest Frontier is. So.
Yeah, well, bare minimum, we've got to get the poop update. I think we decided.
Yeah.
That.
Oh, yeah. Just don't talk to us again until there's poop
until the Night Soil update drops.
Yeah. Guilds would be a really interesting addition too. I don't want to, like, create so much feature bloat that it becomes unplayable. But yeah, guilds would be a really interesting.
So we'll see you all in 2.5 years for the Manor Lords 1.0 show.
Yeah, all right.
We'll see how it goes. See you then.
That's probably about right, I think, in terms of time frame.
Yeah, sounds about right to me.
Not like, you know, 7-8 years like the Rimworld gap, but also not next week.
John, do you have anything to plug this week?
No, I'm delighted to report.
All right. Ian, where's your writing these days?
You can, I've got a guide and a early access look at Manor Lords up at PC Games N. So you can find that there. Otherwise, I'm, as usual, hollering about stuff on Blue Sky.
Minor Blue Sky celebrity, Ian Boudreaux. Brett, where can people find your stuff? And are there any particular blogs that you think would be interesting in the Manor Lords context?
I mean, I did a first impressions of Manor Lords, so that might be interesting. I am at acoup.blog. We are currently marching our way through a series on how the Roman legions defeated the successors of Alexander, It was supposed to be a 4-part series. We're on part like 8 or 9 at this point, because that is how my blog goes. I am also on Twitter as @BrettDevereaux, and I am on Blue Sky as @BrettDevereaux.bluesky or bsky.social, but I am not nearly as cool as Ian on Blue Sky.
And you know, they didn't call him Alexander the Takes 4 blog posts to describe him.
No, actually, I mean, this is one of the things I have set to do is, after the series is done, I have promised some of my patrons a retrospective on Alexander. So I have to write that too.
All right. Three Moves Ahead is hosted on the Idle Thumbs Network. You can find us there at idlethumbs.net/3MA. We are also supported by listeners like you on Patreon. That is patreon.com/3MA. There is going to be another Project Caesar Dev Diary deep dive this month, but it's 4 hours long, and I'm about a third of the way through editing it because we also had a bunch of technical issues. So I'll get it out before the end of the month. I don't want to promise anything else beyond that. You can get access to our Discord server, our multiplayer community. We're playing some asynchronous Solium Infernum right now, which, you know, if you sign up, there's always room to get another lobby going. So that's actually been pretty fun. We might finally do a podcast about that because we have taken the initiative to get a multiplayer game going. Let's see. We're at 3MA on Blue Sky and Twitter. I'm Len on Blue Sky, Till Folkvong on Twitter. Y'all know where to find me. My review of Manor Lords is up on IGN. Please don't yell at me. I'm very sensitive.
Yell at Ian instead.
At least don't yell at me until you've played it. Like, at least play the game, and then you can yell at me all you want.
If you want to yell at Lynn, come to my house and fight me instead.
Yeah, okay, that's a good idea. Yeah.
John has been appointed my champion, so yeah, you have to physically fight him before.
And I do live in one of the gun states, you've been warned.
Yeah. If you need a sword, I have one. You know where I am.
Oh yeah,
that's fine. I'm armored.
Oh right. Yeah. All right.
I have a hawk of chain.
Nice.
I live in a tall stone fortress.
So fight Ian instead, actually.
Whichever one, you know, you have to fight somebody. We'll be back next week with our good friend Brian Cheflubu Smalley to talk a little bit about Shogun and feudal Japan in strategy games. Until then, for Ian and for Brett and for John, this is Len saying goodnight.